This is J.G. Hertzler, General Martok on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to Season 7, Episode 9 of Commentary Trek Stars, a show which deals with the work of Star Trek creators outside of Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm John.
And today we are going to take a look at the other Star Trek Beyond writer, Doug Young. It's one of those things where obviously, you know, people hear like Simon Pegg is writing the new Star Trek movie and that's what they focus on, even if they say like, oh, Simon Pegg and Doug Young are writing the new Star Trek movie, what people take away from that is Simon Pegg is writing the new Star Trek movie.
I mean
the fact that he's the public figure obviously, you know, is a big thing. The fact that he is associated with Star Trek is another big thing, and the fact that he's sort of like an admitted fanboy is another thing. Whereas you say Doug Young is writing Star Trek and everyone's like, who?
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, no one can blame people for doing that because I did the same exact thing, you know?
Yep.
I mean, who's Doug Young? I mean, that's the big question, right?
And yes, it is.
We're going to try to answer that question today. Doug Young is primarily a television writer. That's sort of his bread and butter. He's worked on a number of shows, most notably Big Love, which I've seen some of, although I haven't seen any of his episodes.
I don't know whether I saw any of his episodes. I'm sure that I did because I watched the whole first season of that. It was a well-written show.
Yeah, I think he didn't come in until season two.
Well, then I didn't see any of them because life got busy and I missed the second season. So
that's kind of how it worked with me. You know, I mean, it was really cool, you know, and I mean, hey, Bill Paxton on a weekly basis. I mean, really,
you can't ever have too much Paxton.
No,
that's just a fact of life.
Yes. Yes. And then you throw Harry Dean Stanton into the mix and it's like, okay, you know,
yeah,
let's do this. But yeah, he came in and started writing some season two episodes. He also wrote for a show called Banshee, which I don't know if it's still on or not, but it was a show of note. I haven't seen it myself.
Yes, it was not a show of my note, I can tell you that.
But I hear good things. I hear good things about it. And most notably, he is the co-creator of Dark Blue, which is a show starring Dylan McDermott, which I think was on TNT.
Yeah, that sounds right.
About, I want to say, probably an undercover cop, I think.
Yeah.
I've heard good things about this. This is a show that I've wanted to watch. I just haven't had a chance to. But that's his biggest contribution, I would say, because he was there, I think, the whole time, and he was the co-creator, along with Danny Cannon, the director who, amongst other things, is kind of responsible for the look and feel of Gotham, and he also directed the original Judge Dredd movie. So,
well, yeah. We won't dwell on that because we're talking about Doug Young.
Yes. So TV. TV is where you probably would be most familiar with his work. But he has written one movie, and that movie is Confidence.
Yeah.
Now, this is a movie which it was actually the first thing that he wrote as far as film and television is concerned that got produced, as far as I know. And it was a spec script that he had written and kind of showed to some agents and stuff like that. And it eventually got into the hands of the right people, and they gave it to some other people's hands. And yep. It ended up as a feature film directed by James Foley, who is a director of note. He is the guy who directed Glengarry Glen Ross.
One of the best movies I've ever seen in my life is Glengarry Glen Ross, and it is one I can keep going back to. And so seeing James Foley's name on this, I guarantee you, is what made me and my brother rent it back when we could first lay our hands on Confidence. It was like, directed by Glengarry Glen Ross. Oh, this must be fantastic.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of movies by James Foley because he directed Glengarry Glen Ross. You know, The Corruptor, that was one. It's not a
yeah.
Good
he
movie.
Didn't he do the? It was one of the Grisham ones, The Chamber, with Chris O'Donnell.
Yeah. I think you're right. I haven't seen that one.
Was it Chris O'Donnell or not? Because there was one, The Rainmaker, that wasn't Foley.
No, that was Francis Ford Coppola.
Yes, and that was
Matt Damon.
Yes,
like his first movie, essentially. At least the first time I had seen him in anything.
I think that was his first. He might have filmed it before. No, I think it was his first post Goodwill Hunting movie. But
no, it came out before Goodwill Hunting.
Really?
Yeah, I think it was like
really?
The same year. Yeah, but
oh,
yeah,
no kidding. Huh.
Yeah.
Well, that's surprising.
Yeah, he did Fear, Perfect,
which is a terrible movie. I did watch that movie. I rented it way back when, and I swear to you that Fear is a movie where it's like the idea that Mark Wahlberg could have been in that and Boogie Nights can melt my mind, absolutely melt my mind.
Yeah, I haven't seen Fear. I have to say,
it's not good.
He directed The Chamber. You're right about that one. He did Perfect Stranger, which is a horrible movie.
He did a Madonna movie too.
And some videos for her as well. He directed episodes of Twin Peaks. He directed most recently episodes of Wayward Pines. He directed episodes of House of Cards, Hannibal. He's done a lot of stuff. And I feel kind of bad for him because now he's just signed on to direct the next two.
Yes, he's doing whatever the 50 part 50, 2 and 50 part 3 or whatever it is.
50 Shades Darker and 50 Shades Freed.
Well, you know what? As much as I've been committed to the bit of I'll watch it because the guy who did Glengarry Glen Ross directed it, I draw lines, and that is over the line.
I'm still committed because when 50 Shades of Grey came on HBO the other day, I was like, I'm going to need to watch this so that I can see the other two, right?
No.
And I watched it. I watched
no.
it.
No.
It was, I'm not, is it the worst thing I've ever seen? No. But, I mean, technically, I don't think you can call it a movie because it doesn't have a third act. It's very strange. Very strange.
But, okay, so it's like a sex thriller type movie, right? Or something like
sort
that?
Sort of.
Okay.
Like, more of a romance, I would say.
Is it as bad as, what was that one that Bruce Willis did with Sarah Jessica Parker? Was that Striking Distance?
I don't know. I didn't see that one.
No, that one was, because, he played like a boat cop or something like that. It was awful. Okay, because that's like sort of bottom of the scale for me of the ones that I've seen.
Yeah. No, this it doesn't really work, I have to say. It's disappointing.
But at the very least, he had the pleasure of directing Doug Young's big screen script, Confidence.
He did, Confidence, which was a movie that came out in 2003. It starred Edward Burns, Dustin Hoffman, lots of really big people or people who would go on to become really big, like Paul Giamatti, who at the time I don't think really was a big name.
Well, no, he was at least known as a character actor by that point because I know that Private Parts had come out before then.
Okay.
So people knew who Paul Giamatti was, but he was still at that level of, like now people say Paul Giamatti and just about everybody knows who you're talking about. He was still at that level of looking to truly monopolize on name recognition.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you know, I for years I didn't know this, but Paul Giamatti is the son of A. Bartlett Giamatti, the former commissioner of Major League Baseball.
I had no idea about that. I really didn't. That's
crazy.
Wow.
Wow. Who knew? Yeah. I mean, A. Bartlett Giamatti had passed away long before Paul Giamatti had made a name for himself. So, you know, there isn't that sort of, you know, continuance or whatever, but
it's not like Rooney Mara or something like that,
right. So lots of people. Rachel Weisz is in it as well, and Louis Guzman and Andy Garcia shows up,
and one of my favorite character actors of all time, Donald Logue, is in it.
Yes, he is,
and I light up whenever I see him on screen because he's just always great.
Have you been watching Gotham with him in it?
I have not had a chance to keep up with Gotham, but he was my favorite part of it. Like, I'm dead serious. Whenever he walks on screen, if I find out he's in something, I'm like, okay, I'm going to stick with this at least for a little while.
Isn't he in Vampires?
No, he is in Blade, the first Blade.
Oh, okay.
And he is absolutely transcendently wonderful in that movie. He's like, he should have been the main bad guy in Blade. Yeah. Not Stephen Dorff, right?
Stephen Dorff. Yeah.
Should have been Donal Logue.
Oh, well. What can you do? But yes, would you want to give a sort of a synopsis of this thing?
Yeah, Confidence is, I would call it a sort of paint-by-numbers heist movie. I know it's about people playing the long con and stuff like that, but it is really sort of, you know what you're going to get when you sit down to Confidence. It's going to be a movie where they're going to have sequences where they show you what's going on, and it's about a guy who is pulling a big score against like the most feared sort of mob guy in the LA area, played by Dustin Hoffman.
Yeah. It's, I mean, paint by numbers, I think, is sort of like key to this. You know, it's very much like if you were to compare it to something, you know, Ocean's 11, I think, would be a good comparison.
I completely agree, because it does the whole thing of showing what they're going to do in montage as they're describing it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at several points during the movie. Oh, well, what we're going to do is we're going to get the money and make the exchange at the customs guy. That's a bad idea. Okay. And they rewind the film. It's like, and then they show him putting like the bribe under the bag and stuff like that. And they just keep showing different versions of it, so that when you get to the end, you find out, oh no, wait, here was this permutation of the plan, and this is why it worked.
Right. And, you know, it's got the same sort of thing with assembling the team and everything like that. It does kind of wrap it in this, like, interesting structural package of, you know, it being told in flashback and sort of, like, flashbacks within flashbacks to some extent. There's, like, a narrator. It's being narrated. You know, the first thing that you see is Edward Burns lying in the middle of an alley, shot to death, and he's narrating this story and saying, like, okay, I'm dead. How did I get here? You know? And then it takes you back to him with a gun to his head in that same alley, and he's telling the story to the person who's holding the gun on his head, Morris Chestnut. And so it's kind of like flashbacks inside flashbacks. It's a very intricate structure, which is interesting. And I mean, I guess this would be, you know, sort of my take on the movie is, as far as these heist movies are concerned and these sort of like, you know, con movies, what you're saying is true, that, you know what's going to happen. It's predictable and everything. But part of the fun of it, or in some cases all of the fun of it, is trying to figure out exactly how it's all put together, how it's all going to work.
Yeah, you know that they're trying to slip something by you, so you watch the movie thinking, okay, what is it in that they're trying to slip by me?
Yeah.
And while I'm not going to like praise the movie, I think you're right to call out the intricacy of it, because it is layered and you never get lost during the movie. And I know that part of that is the direction, but part of that is editing, but part of that is also the script that it starts from.
Mm-hmm.
It's obviously constructed in a solid enough fashion that it's like, well, this isn't going to be like an Oscar winning film. It's going to be a pleasant distraction. Basically, this is going to be something where you're not going to regret watching it, even though you might not be, you know, seeking out, you're not going to run into Blockbuster and be like, I got to rent Confidence. But if you rent it, you're gonna be like, yeah, that was good. I like that.
Yeah. And that's pretty much the reaction that I remember having to it back then. And it's really interesting because, like, I saw it when it first came out, and I keep on, you know, sort of mentioning it to people because of Doug Young, mainly, you know, recently, which is now 12 years later, and saying, like, he did that movie Confidence. And people will say, oh, yeah, I saw that. What was that one about? And then I'll say, you know, I don't really remember. But like everyone's sort of in agreement. It's like, yeah, that was a good movie. What was it about? You know, I mean, that's really kind of like how all of these conversations go, you know, myself included. I'm like, I don't know. Like I was talking about it with Max the other day, and he's like, I remember there being colors. And I'm like, yeah, yes. No, you're right. I totally remember the colors.
Yeah.
And he's like, I don't remember anything other than that. I'm like, me either.
But the thing is, that's an interesting signature of Foley was like, mm-hmm. that's what jumps out at you is he did the same sort of thing with the way he lit a lot of scenes in Glengarry Glen Ross was there was a lot of like heavy saturation of a red or a green window, like behind somebody, all not comic booky, but very saturated. Like the colors were very, you know, there. They very much defined the space, as it were.
Yeah, I love the look of this movie for sure. You know, I love that sort of saturated color photography and everything. It's very simple and yet effective and fun. You know, it kind of signals a certain type of fun.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that this movie is fun, even though it's sort of like a darker Ocean's 11, to be sure. You know, Ocean's 11 is sort of very lighthearted and, you know, airy or whatever. Whereas this, you know, has a bit of a hard edge to it. And yet it never sort of like loses that sense of fun, I don't think.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that, you know, if there's anything I'm going to really heap praise on, and of course, part of this is performance, but again, part of this is the writing of the character. But the character of King, played by Dustin Hoffman, is a really well-made character. Like, he's the sort of character that you walk away from at the end of the movie, and you're like, it was catchy what they did with him. You know, they gave him enough sort of idiosyncratic tics to make him memorable. Like, he's the thing I remember most about the movie, seeing it back then, and then as I'm rewatching it, I'm like, oh yeah, now I that's right. He's got the ADD and he's got those sort of weird personality quirks, but they're not as annoyingly over the top as I'm trying to remember the director's name, but he did that one with David Caruso and Nicolas Cage, where I can't remember the name of it.
Oh, was that Jade?
No, Jade was the other one. It had Sam Jackson in it too, which was actually the reason I went to go see it. But basically he made in that movie, that director made Nicolas Cage so over the top in terms of his idiosyncrasies that you started to get bored with him by the end. Whereas, and that was just the way Cage was written. And of course also partially performance at the very least. But then you have this character that is really well put together. I mean, he just really is. Like, just you can tell that there was something for Hoffman to have fun with and work with on the page, that he wasn't straining himself to make this character interesting. The character was just interesting as he was constructed.
Yeah, I would agree. It was a well put together character, and you know, there were a lot of other characters in this movie which were distinct, and you know, it's hard, especially when you're making these sort of heist movies with these teams, and it's like, well, how do you distinguish one from the other? And I think they did a good job with that, you know, giving them each their own personalities and unique quirks and everything. And you know, it's one of those things where while I do appreciate the characters and I do appreciate the structure on a technical level, I feel like once it's all put together, it doesn't really add up to much. You know, it's a fun thing to watch, but it's also the type of thing where, like, if you were to ask me now, like, what was going on in that movie thematically, I'm not really sure I'd be able to tell you.
Oh, I don't think there was anything really thematically going on.
Yeah.
And I agree. Yeah, it's a distraction.
Mm-hmm.
It's not anything that you're going to, you know, run around and fall in love with, but it's, you know, you're not going to regret seeing it.
And I think, you know, the fact that this came out right in between Ocean's 11 and Ocean's 12, you know, where you've got someone, you know, filmmakers who are at the very tip top of their game doing basically the same.
Oh boy, here comes the Soderbergh speech, everybody. Here it comes. Strap yourselves in. We're going to Soderbergh. Yes.
Yeah. I want to live in Soderbergh. All right. No, but I mean, like, when you've got that, you know, as sort of like the gold standard, and this is sort of like the big, maybe the golden age of these types of movies. Something like Confidence is just not going to stack up.
I'm going to be bold enough to say that I liked it better than Ocean's 12. And I know you're going to consider that heresy, but Ocean's 12 is, there are just too many things that are bad about that movie for me to like it.
Ocean's 12 is...
Don't. No.
So no. close to being no. a masterpiece, it's no. not even funny.
No.
And it's one of those things where, like, I would say that Ocean's 11 is a better movie than Ocean's 12. But Ocean's 12's existence, the stuff that they did in that movie is so freaking insane that you just have to love it.
No, you don't.
Because it is
He's lying to you, everybody.
Amazing that it exists.
These are lies coming out of your mouth. Ocean's 11, I love. Ocean's 13, against my better judgment, I love. Ocean's 12 is just, that's a big egg sitting in the middle of that pristine nest that he's built.
Ocean's 11 is, I love. Ocean's 13 is largely insignificant because it's basically the exact same thing as Ocean's 11.
But revisiting stuff, as we have found out with a very popular movie that has come out recently, is not necessarily a bad thing. Just having a different take on sort of the same story beats can be fun and enjoyable.
But that's all that Ocean's 13 was. It was kind of fun. It was like a less good version of Ocean's 11, whereas Ocean's 12 was like, we're going to do something different. We're going to do something way outside of the box. And we're going to trick people into, you know, giving us $100 million to make an art house movie. And then we're going to trick people into going to see that art house movie.
Okay. So you're saying that, like, it was sort of like a Banksy movie, is what you're saying.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to issue this challenge to the audience, our audience that's listening to this right now. I want you to go... And I want you to rent Ocean's 12, and I want you to rent Confidence, and I want you to watch both of them. I request politely for you to watch them. I'm not demanding anything. I'm just requesting politely. And I want you, when we post this, when this episode drops, I want you to let us know who's right on this one. Is Ocean's 12 better or is Confidence better? Just a head-to-head matchup.
Yeah, I want to hear that too. I want to hear that too, and then I want to have a follow-up discussion here where we talk about how everyone is crazy. So,
I will warn everybody that if I lose this bet, I will cry. I will cry. So if you want to make me cry, then go ahead and say Ocean's 12 is better.
I did a whole thing for the Talk Film Society about Ocean's 12 where we were talking about how brilliant it is. And how there's this thing on the commentary for Schizopolis where Steven Soderbergh talks about how in that movie he breaks the fourth wall, and how in his next movie he's going to break the fifth wall, which is slightly behind the fourth wall. And that movie, which he's going to do that in, is called Ocean's 12. And then you watch Ocean's 12 and you're like, wow, he actually did that. That's crazy.
The fifth wall. He broke time itself.
Yeah.
He transcended self-awareness. He is Skynet.
Yeah, yeah.
All right.
And I mean, for those people who aren't familiar with Soderbergh, obviously he was joking on the Schizopolis commentary, but that doesn't mean that he didn't do it because he's Soderbergh.
He's so crazy that he out-crazied himself.
Exactly. Exactly. Anyway, okay.
But did any of the characters jump out to you? Like, besides Hoffman, which, I mean, I think is an easy one to sort of, you know, grab onto. Was there anybody that's sort of like a standout in this to you?
I mean, you've got such great actors, you know, and I can only imagine for someone like Young, who this is his first freaking movie, and he's got the guy who made, you know, it's like Glenn Gary, Glenn Ross. It's like, okay, well, that script was written by David Mamet. you know?
From a Pulitzer Prize-winning play.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's like, now he's doing my movie. And it's like, I mean, that's got to be just mind-blowing. And then the talent which is involved in this thing. I mean, everyone. Edward Burns, you know, to Rachel Weisz, to Paul Giamatti, Louis Guzman. I mean, come on. You know, in addition to Dustin Hoffman and everything, I mean, that's just crazy. That must just be a dream come true. I mean, to see, yeah, like, this script which you wrote for yourself, essentially, to be, like, now performed by, like, some of the greatest actors of our time. I mean, that's just amazing.
I'd be happy just with Andy Garcia.
Yeah, yeah. You know? And he has kind of a throwaway role in this thing. You know, he does,
but he makes it live. He brings that Andy Garcia-ness to it.
Yeah.
It's just so enjoyable.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I really like the stuff with Edward Burns and Rachel Weisz. I think that they really, you know, have good chemistry and everything like that. I mean, Rachel Weisz is so good and everything. And,
yeah, that's true.
You know, I also, Paul Giamatti, anytime he's on screen, it's just captivating.
Oh, well, when they're at the lunch and he starts, you know, going off, it's a very well-written bit. But when he starts going off about, you know, he's asking about the quality of the bathroom. Mm-hmm. And the guy's like, what's your problem? And he's like, are you kidding? In a big city like this, health inspections, the bathroom is at the bottom of the list. And, like, she's trying to eat her soup. And Giamatti just keeps going on about how filthy bathrooms are and they have to be clean and everything like that. That's a fun scene to watch.
Yeah. Yeah, it is for sure. For sure. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of good stuff in this movie. You know, it's definitely not a bad movie by any stretch of the imagination, but it doesn't have that extra added something that you need to make it great. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you know, one of the things that worked against it, for me, at least, is I'm not a prude by any stretch. I'm a Quentin Tarantino fan. You can't be a prude and be a Tarantino fan. But there's a way to use foul language. There is an art to it, especially in film. And this dialogue definitely had too much of a reliance on the F-bomb. Mm-hmm. It was too prevalent. It was like, I get it. You know, I'm not looking for clean language in the movie, but it's almost like it was used as a cheat for emotional emphasis. You know, like they couldn't find a way to punch it up to give the character more oomph in their actual line, so he drops in, you know, he sprinkles an F-bomb in some of the lines, and it's like that doesn't add any weight to the scene. It's just you making them say F more often.
Yeah, I guess I mean I know the type of thing that you're talking about, and that's certainly, you know, something which I think can be overdone at times. I mean, the example that I always give, which was really sort of a turnoff to me when I first saw it, was The Wire. The early episodes of The Wire, I felt they were like using profanity just for the sake of saying, like, I'm using profanity. And I quickly got over that because it's The Wire, you know?
Yeah. Well, but the thing is, I think the turning point for The Wire is in the first season when they're going and they're investigating a crime scene and all they use is the F word.
Uh-huh.
Like while they're like measuring out the bullet holes and stuff like that, and it's just variations on the F word. That's a masterful scene. That is a beautifully constructed and well-written use of the F word right there.
Yeah,
whereas this
yeah.
just felt like it was just used as a cheat.
I mean, to me, it didn't bother me, you know, because it felt appropriate to these characters, you know. I mean, I don't know. Maybe I just use the F word too much in my daily vocabulary or
possible.
Something. I mean,
possible.
You know, whatever. So I never even, like, the one thing which kind of stood out to me was, like, when I was watching it, I was kind of thinking, like, just thinking back to when I had seen it, I was like, is this PG-13 or is this rated R? I forget. And then when I was watching it, you know, the profanity, it was, you know, so frequent that I thought, like, wow, yeah, this is definitely not a PG-13 movie. You know, that's cool that they, you know, did not feel the need to, you know, censor themselves or whatever. And, you know, especially for a low budget thing like this, you know, because they could have easily made it PG-13 if they wanted to, if they had just rewritten a lot of the dialogue and stuff. Because there's not like excessive violence or, you know, sex or anything like that in there.
No, yeah, it is restrained in those regards. Absolutely. But, which would be actually kind of in keeping. It'll be interesting. Maybe I would be interested in seeing the 50 Shades sequels then, because those are all centered on sex. And that's kind of with Foley, as he's always been. And of course, you know, it's a function of the screenplay as well. But like, he directs things very well in that he's restrained in that regard, you know, of the works that I've seen him do.
Man, if he takes the sex out of the 50 Shades sequels, I can only imagine the riots in the streets.
Now that would be breaking the fifth wall.
Yeah.
Right
yeah.
there.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, well. So, yeah. So that's confidence. I mean, any final thoughts on confidence?
Yeah. You know, if you see it playing or they make it, you know, no extra charge to watch on Prime. Yeah, you know, it's not a bad hour and a half.
Yeah. I guess to me, the thing that I kind of took away from it is, like, for whatever reason, it really just took me back to that time and place when it came out. You know, I was working as a projectionist and everything. I remember vividly screening this movie, you know. I watched it with Max when it first came out, and he apparently took note of the colors. And, you know, there were so many movies like this at the time that watching this movie just really took me back to that time. And, you know, I kind of like that time in my life a lot, because it was, you know, I was in college and I was just kind of I had literally moved out of my parents' house like a month before this movie came out, you know? So it was very sort of like, you know, hey, I'm on top of the world sort of thing. And then just to top it all off, you know, as if this wasn't enough of a trip down memory lane, you know, in sort of a subliminal sense, then the end credits have a Coldplay song on there. And I'm like,
yeah.
Okay, well, yeah, not that I'm a fan of Coldplay or anything like that, but I've come to appreciate them more now than I did in 2003, I can tell you that. But
well, he broke himself free from the goop tangle, so that's cool. Good for him. He broke Paltrow's evil hold on his brain.
Oh, is that what?
Yeah, isn't the lead singer Cold? No, isn't that the lead singer of Coldplay? He used to be, yes, Chris Martin, right?
I don't know.
Yeah, he was married to Gwyneth Paltrow, and then like he became sane and left.
Oh,
so,
yeah. Oh, maybe we can talk about that next week with our Gwyneth Paltrow movie.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, maybe we could.
Anyway, so yeah, I don't know. That was fun. That was fun, but whatever. So what does this mean to Star Trek Beyond? Watching Confidence, seeing the type of thing that Doug Young writes, how do you take that info and apply it to, you know, expectations for Star Trek Beyond?
I'll go back to what you called out again, the intricacy. He is going to be able to make sure that things are structured in such a way that they're going to be, they will feel free, I think, to make it dense, but understandable. You know, like it will work on, they'll be able to juggle multiple plot lines without it feeling like a big mess. Things will remain clear. And so like I have confidence now that this is going to be the type of movie where they're going to be able to throw a bunch of things, but keep all of those balls in the air so that, you know, you're able to keep up with it.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of think the exact same thing, you know, in terms of like structural proficiency or whatever. I think that he's on par with Simon Pegg. I just hope that they're able to bring a bit more to it than just that. But I do think that, and I mean, this is a big problem with a lot of movies. You know, I do think that from a technical standpoint, the script will be sound. So that's that. One more thing, I guess, because he seems to have a good relationship now with Bad Robot, and I think he was maybe writing a movie for them prior to Beyond, and that's sort of how he got involved with the Beyond team and everything. But I guess they must be happy with the work that he's doing, because he's now writing another movie for Bad Robot, a science fiction film called The God Particle. So don't really know anything about it, but it will be out, who knows when, 2017? I don't know.
Awesome. No, that's great. I mean, when they're willing to give somebody a script, I mean, that's sort of like... you know, to bring up somebody who's in the news right now because of what he's doing or what he has done, Kasdan.
Yeah.
He Lucas brought him on for, you know, because Raiders and Empire were going on. And Kasdan was like, what if I'm no good? He's like, yeah, I think you're good. Yeah. And it's like, so, you know, that's a big vote of confidence for a screenwriter to be given another project. It really is.
Yeah, for sure. Well, it'll be exciting to see what happens.
Yeah.
All right, before we go, bit of sad news this week. George Clayton Johnson passed away. George Clayton Johnson is the writer of the very first Star Trek episode to ever air, The Man Trap. That's the only Star Trek episode that he wrote, but he did write a bunch of other stuff in a bunch of different media, I don't know. He did the novel, Logan's Run, that the movie was based on. He wrote the story for the original Ocean's 11, speaking of Ocean's 11.
Ooh, what an interconnected world.
Yeah, yeah. And he also wrote a bunch of episodes of The Twilight Zone, including, I would say probably most notable would be Kick the Can, which was then used by Spielberg, right? Or was it, was it Spielberg who did the Kick the Can episode?
I think so.
In the movie?
I think you're right.
So he's done tons and tons of stuff. And apparently he was a really cool guy and obviously a really great writer. And, you know, he will be missed. Well, it's been fun talking about Doug Young this week, but that's not the only thing we're talking about here on Trek FM. So here's a look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
Usually Mike and I are like,
what's going on? Our heads are just spinning like, what? I don't understand what's going on, you know? And, like, you know, when I listen to that, I'm like, are we, like, you know, bad?
The orb.
He requested, you know, a Bajoran officer to serve with him on purpose, you know. He understands. You make this their own. We can't.
I'm glad he did it on purpose. I could see him, like, accidentally requesting a Bajoran officer. Oh, man, I checked the wrong box on the form. Damn.
The Ready Room.
Actually, I think at this point, Vulcan Love Slave was probably just a short story, right? It hadn't been turned into a full-blown
That's right. It's not a full-blown novel at that point. Yeah.
It's just fanfic. It's just fanfic.
Yeah, just fanfic. Right.
Just on the internet. People started writing after First Contact there in Montana.
To the journey! It's a very much the genesis of Seven of Nine.
Genesis alone is not. Sorry.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
So we're closing in on the World Series is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course, the Sox were able to win the World Series in, you know, 12 games. So we're no White Sox, but we're like the Cubs or something. Oh, no, wait. They didn't win the World Series. Never mind.
The 602 Club.
To speak back to the lightsaber overall, I mean, it was practical reasons that they switched it to green, but I've always loved the fact that Luke had that green saber, even when I was a kid. Like, it's really cool. It's an immediate visual signal, you know, even outside of the outfit that he's wearing, that he's a different kind of person than even we saw in the previous film. And I really like that.
Literary Treks.
The pinnacle of episode that we've ever done on that was probably when we had Tristan from To the Journey on to talk about some Voyager comics. And we ended up, that show was named Tuvok's Remedial School for Badasses or something of that nature. So, I mean, yeah, these old comics can just be very, very fun.
Meta Treks.
I looked it up, and ornare is the Latin word for to adorn.
That's fascinating.
So I looked up breca, and it turns out the same spelling, B-R-E-K-K-A, is Old Norse for slope or hillside.
And that, listeners, is something you will only get right here on Metatrex.
Better living through etymology.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out these shows. You can get all the links up there on our website. You can find us on Stitcher, iTunes, TuneIn, Windows Phone, SoundCloud, or you can just download it directly from the website at trek.fm. So be sure to check us all out over there. So if you want to help us out, you can buy some of our stuff. If you go to trek.fm/store, that'll take you to our network store page on Redbubble, where you can get T-shirts and sweatshirts and hoodies and bumper stickers and everything.
Cool stuff.
I got some cool stuff for Christmas, you know, a Trek FM shirt and everything like that. So, there's lots of good stuff on there. So head on over and check it out. You know, lots of cool designs by Aaron, who does all of the artwork for the website. And definitely.
He does, he does great work. He really
does. He does, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And another way you can help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And if you want to contact us, you can contact us several ways. You can do it through a form at trek.fm/contact. For voicemail, you can go to Trek FM and look in the sidebar on the show page, or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm. If you want to reach out to the network on Twitter, it's at Trek FM. Facebook.com/TrekFM. You can actually join us in the Babel Conference. Type the Babel Conference, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar. It's an exclusive group for listeners of the network only.
Yeah. Well, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Kessel Junkie. And you can find me on another podcast called Words with Nerds that I do with my buddy Craig, where we argue about a lot of things. But it's all geeky things, and it's all done with love. We argue with love.
Well, that's good. That's good.
And where can they find you, Mike?
You can find me on CommentaryTrackStars.com doing what we're now calling Commentary Track Stars. We were going to call it Commentary Track Stars Unlimited. We were going to call it whatever. But yeah, as you'll see starting this week, we're like, let's stop fitting things into boxes and just do whatever we want, and that'll make for better conversation. So this week,
awesome,
you can check out Commentary Track Stars episode 455, which is just what we're calling it, because that's what it is.
Awesome.
So you can find that on CommentaryTrackStars.com. You can also find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K. You can find us on Twitter at ComTrackStars. You can email us at ComTrackStars@gmail.com. So another way that you can help us out is by patronizing our sponsor, Audible, audible.com, where you can get tons of books that you can listen to.
Yes, and actually, you can go, you can download them, and Audible is a great way to actually catch up on all of the books that you've always been meaning to read, but can't ever quite seem to find the quiet time to read. I know that I use Audible. I know, Mike, you use Audible. It's a great tool.
So what book do you have for us this week, John?
The book we have this week in honor of George Clayton Johnson is Logan's Run. It's written by William F. Nolan with George Clayton Johnson, and it's narrated by Oliver Wyman. And the description is, it's the 23rd century, and at age 21, your life is over. Logan Six has been trained to kill, born and bred from conception to be the best of the best. But his time is short, and before his life ends, he's got one final mission. Find and destroy Sanctuary, a fabled haven for those that chose to defy the system. But when Logan meets and falls in love with Jessica, he begins to question the very system he swore to protect, and soon they're both running for their lives. As a Trek FM listener, you can get a free audiobook like this one of your choice, along with the 30-day trial to see just how great Audible is. Just go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up today. Again, that's audibletrial.com/trekfm, and we thank Audible for supporting Commentary Trek Stars and the network.
Yes. All right, so we got a taste of Doug Young. You know, we gave him his due or whatever, and that covers all of the writing by all of the Star Trek Beyond writers that
yes. have
written the current script. And next week, we're going to go back to JJ. What we're going to do is look at, you know, sort of the producer aspect of JJ. You know, if people are like, oh, J.J. Abrams is producing this movie. He's not directing, but he's producing. Well, what does that mean? Well, we're going to find out with a new series where we look at all of the movies that J.J. has produced for other people. You know, we're not going to look at the movies that he produced for that he directed himself, you know, because we've already talked about all of those. We're going to look at the movies that he produced for other people. And we're going to start this series up with the very first movie that he produced back before he was a director himself. He produced a movie for his friend Matt Reeves, and that movie is The Pallbearer.